It's April the 6th, and this is the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. And we are here today to hear from some of our college presidents. First, I'd like to open public hearing on Senate Bill 5524. And Mr. Wilson.
First things first, Mr. Chair, we have forgotten to introduce our new committee assistant, Michael Graham, up to this point. As you know, Julie is still working for us, but she's student teaching in the morning, and Michael has slid in to do a very good job so far, and hopefully there'll be there's been a smooth transition. And with that, this day has been set aside for presentations by the various community colleges. We'll set a day aside for the public universities next week for the same purpose. There's a number of speakers, and I believe Ms. Henderson is going to lead things off, I believe.
Andrea, come on up. Even though this is Portland State Day at the Capitol, we are hearing from the community colleges.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And we have a presentation for you this morning from the colleges to really talk about where the colleges are going. What are the major issues that we're grappling with? What are we working on? Kind of what's the strategic direction? And ending with a little bit about the funding and what we're able to do. So I hope this is helpful for you as you consider the budgets this year. And with that, I will get started.
Mr. Chair, just real briefly, we are on page 249, I believe, of the presentation. It's back on the 27th.
So I wanted to start with a quote to really emphasize that the comprehensive nature of community colleges and how important each of the community colleges are for their individual community. And it's a comprehensive mission that's far beyond just the first 2 years of a four-year degree. But it's really about all the educational opportunities that each particular community needs. And I think that one of the key pieces of that is each college looks different. And as you talk about the mix of CTE programs or adult education or community education, the mix is different in each college because each college goes through a process to identify what that community needs are and how do they best meet the needs and prioritize the educational opportunities for the members of their communities. So I really wanted to kind of start with that piece. And to, again, start with a second quote, which I think really captures where we are as community colleges. Community colleges in Oregon really started in the 1960s, and that was the 60s and the 70s were a time across the country where community colleges were opening, the fundamental purpose of the community colleges was about open access. It was about the opportunities for anybody who walks in the door to get the help and the education that they needed. And what we've seen over the last 10 years or so is a fundamental shift in that mission to understanding that access for our students isn't enough. If we don't have a focus on the success of those students, the completion of the students, we're really missing what the students need. And we started a process in Oregon to take a really hard look at our data. It started back in about 2008 to ask the question of how are our students doing when they walk in the door? How many of them are actually getting the outcome they needed? How many of them are graduating? And frankly, we didn't like the numbers that we saw and really focused our efforts around how do we help the completion of our students and what is it that we need to do to really kind of focus around that. And so we started a student success oversight committee and came up with at the time the 26 best practices around student success. And what this slide shows you is some of the different interventions that we did on behalf of our students and how many of the colleges implemented those interventions. So you can see up at the top, our colleges redid their new student orientation. Many of them required a student success course, increased tutoring services, implemented an academic warning system. all of the different pieces that literature showed make a difference for completion of students. Structured first-year experiences, at the time, 10 colleges implemented that. Since then, all 17 have now implemented it with money that we received as part of the Oregon Promise. But the idea behind all of this was, how do we provide the student supports that our students need to help them to succeed? I think the biggest fear was that our students were coming in the door, racking up debt, and leaving without anything meaningful. And for a number of our students, we were leaving our students in a worse place than when they walked in the door. So as we did this work, we could see, and you can see in later slides, and I know that you were shared a slide yesterday, we have more outcomes for our students. We have more students that are graduating. Our certificate and degree numbers are increasing. And a lot of this can be attributed to the work that the community colleges did. So the next big piece of work that we did was around developmental education, and to really think about a redesign of that developmental education. So as you know, many of our students came in and tested into what was less than college level work. Many of those students that once they tested into less than college level work never made it back out and didn't succeed and didn't complete. And so we started work around 3 years ago. And what we did essentially was convene faculty from across the state to engage in a process to rethink, using best practices and literature and reviews from around the country, how can we best help those students. And from that, implemented a number of different measures to decrease the number of students that are going into developmental ed. Probably the most important one of those is the idea of co-requisite enrollment. So to put students that, even though they're not ready for, say, writing 121, that they can go into writing 121 and have supports on the side to help them complete that writing 121 class. And the literature and the research shows that that is much more beneficial for students. So we're ending 3 years of developmental ed reform to really help our students. And so what I wanted to then, so this is where we've been, and really want to shift and talk about, so where we're going next and what's the big heavy lift that we need to do on behalf of our students. And that really is the concept of guided pathways. So all of the work we've done so far has been around the support services for our students. Now we need to rethink the academic path for students and how they move through through their courses in a way that's more helpful to them. And I'm going to now turn this over to Greg Heyman, who's the president of Lynn Benton Community College. They're one of 30 colleges nationwide that's been selected to be a leader college around implementing guided pathways, to talk a little bit about guided pathways and their experience at Lynn Benton Community College.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. I guess for the record, I'm Greg Heyman, Lynn Benton Community College. Guided pathways is really a change in the way in which we think about how we deliver education. And I want to go back to Andrea's quote about how recognition in terms of the changing environment also required of us to do, and we use the word redesign, our institutions, redesign our missions, redesign the educational experience that our students have. Guided Pathways is a foundational structure by which we pursue that. And this is a statewide initiative of ours, but Lynn Benton has had, I think, the privilege of being part of sort of the first wave of this work, which partly means we get to learn by our mistakes, but we're excited to be about that. I want to talk a little bit about what that looks like on our campuses. You can see a number of the components of guided pathways there. One of the most, I would say, important things about guided pathways is sort of, in a very intentional way, sort of reverses the way in which we think about a student's educational experience. I think historically, because of our focus on access, which we are in no way interested in stepping away from, we sort of let students come in, and we thought that eventually they'd sort of figure out where they want to end up. Guided pathways starts with a discussion about where do you want to end up. And once we, with students, help them to understand that, then we plot a pathway to that goal. And so the point of guided pathways is to have clear pathways for students to achieve the goals that they have set, and then create structures that help make that possible. For us, that means, and these are pretty big lifts, but for that means we have to change in which we design our programs. are literally step into each one of our, in our case, 86 programs and change the way in which they're designed. We have to change in the ways in which we schedule courses so that once a student is on a path, we need to make sure that those courses are available at the time at which they need them on that pathway. That requires us to change our design there. It also means we have to help students to be more have more access to information about where they are on their path. And one of the things that we're working on and other schools are working on is, and it uses technology to do this, but we want students to be able to go to their place in the website, and one of the things they see is a illustration of their path. Here's your path. Here's where you are. Here's what you've already completed. Here's what you're doing now. Here's what you need to do next. And completion is this far away, and you're doing a great job, and we just have this much more to do. And the research would tell us that if we can help students to actually see that whole frame and understand their place in it, that they're more motivated, they know what their goal is, they know where they are in the path toward that goal, and they move forward with greater success. Guided Pathways has two pieces. We've just talked about the pathways part. The other part is the guidance part, and edits require us to really redesign the way in which we do advising. Some of it, Andrea has already talked about in terms of the way in which you do intake or on-ramp, how we engage with students right from the start. But it also means that advising becomes more of a intentional, we use the word intrusive, intrusive advising, so that it isn't like, well, if I need help, I might go talk to my advisor. It is that the advisor and the student become a partner in that student's success, and they work with that student through their progression along that pathway. At our institution, we have a number of handoff points as that student becomes more clear of his or her goal. So we have more general advising that starts. We work with something we call meta majors. One of the ways, I'm sure you're all aware of this, but one of the things that makes it difficult for students to make program choices is that we have 86 of them. And the research says that when we have more than 7 options, our capacity to choose goes down. So we don't reduce the number of choices. We nest them so that you only have to make 1 of 7 choices first, and then 1 of 7 more, and 1 of 7 more. You know what? You do the math, and you end up with 86, and you're just fine. But the student was never faced with more than 7 options at a given time. Well, that first step is to choose a meta major, which is a collection of programmatic areas that have content in common. And so I might say, well, I think I want to do something in the social sciences. We have a lot of different social science programs. The student doesn't have to decide which one of them. They only have to decide that they're interested in social sciences, and then we put them on the starting point of a pathway which works as a starting point for all of those programs. So they don't lose credits, which is another critical feature of guided pathways. We want to make sure that every credit they take counts so that they can move most efficiently, most effectively, at the lowest cost to them and to us as they achieve their educational goals. And we're excited to be able to be working with that. I'll just move on to just a couple of illustrations about sort of how this works. One of the ways in which we might describe the pass is a cafeteria college, in the sense that you have a lot of foods in front of you and get to go down the line and pick what you want. And one of the things that results of that for students, and it just goes, is the path that student has in front of them is unclear to them, unclear to us sometimes. We have a tendency to sort students in ways that may not be most effective in terms of helping them achieve their goals. We don't have an effective way, and they don't have an effective way of monitoring their progress because we don't know sometimes even what the goal is. How do we know what the progress is? You know, I love the illustration of the GPS. All of us, I think, use them now. We go into our telephone or our car, and the first thing you say is, well, where do you want to go? And once you decide, that computer plots a pathway for you. And so that critical choice of, you know, it doesn't work if you don't know where you're going. And so Guided Pathways works very hard to help students understand what they're going, what learning goals that they have. And I just want to, in comparison, show what I think a Guided Pathways college looks like for students. I think students have clear roadmaps. So, again, our goal is by the end of their time with us, they have enough information and enough experience that they're self-guiding, because that's what they're going to have to do in the world. But we need to help support them as they move toward that. We create intake models that are not barriers to their success, but pathways to their success. We and they track their progress, and they know exactly what they're learning. They have specific learning outcomes. They know what they know, and they know what they can do at the end of their time with us, and that contributes to their capacity to be successful when they leave us. So this is, I would think, we certainly believe that this is a sort of an overarching strategy that is, I think, foundational to helping the work that Andrea has described. But we need to see, in addition to access, we need to see more and more of our students being successful in their educational pursuits and as they move on in their life. So, thank you.
Mr.
Representative Lively.
Co-chair, thank you very much. And I applaud the work you're doing and the progress you've made. So I'm trying to understand in all of this, though, the student responsibility or accountability, and I appreciate all the supports in that, and things obviously are different today than they were in 1965 when I started community college. But nonetheless, I'm still trying, and good work, but I'm trying to understand, so what's the student's responsibility or accountability that success part?
Representative Lively and the committee, I think that's a great question, and as I probably didn't speak too well enough, our goal is to give students the information and the resources to become self-guiding. So their responsibility is to come to that place where they have a clear sense of their future, and they know how to plot a path to get there. I would think I think one of the things in my teaching that I have the privilege of teaching one class at Oregon State, but one of the things that I say to them, and I believe and I find in my class, is once I can help a student understand what it is that they want to achieve, they are extremely motivated in getting there. And I think way too often what we sometimes have done is sort of we'll do education, but we're not quite sure what the goal is yet. And Guided Pathways focuses on helping students to set a goal for themselves. And I believe once they do that, they actually develop sense of responsibility, but they're motivated to get there. So thank you for that
Great,
question.
Thank you.
It used to seem like that students were, that the whole system was failing, because a fairly high percentage of students that showed up at our community colleges had to do remedial programs, especially in language arts and in math. And they had to do the 80-something or 90-something level courses before they could qualify for the 100 and 200 level courses. Now you've moved on to where the students take those 100 level classes and you give them the additional assistance on the side to help them catch up to where we would hope they would have been at when they graduated from high school. I just think that is a marvelous addition to the overall system, because it looked like a lot of these students that were showing up in our community colleges were a product of failure. I mean, frankly, if they had to take a remedial class, that meant that the high schools had failed, and we tended to think of it that way. We at the legislature here, and we're providing some of the funding, thought about it that way. So I'm very, very pleased with this new new program where you're giving students assistance and allowing them to earn credit and giving them a little additional help on the side to catch up. I remember when I was teaching at a local college, I had students that came to me and said, Professor Monroe, I've always gotten straight A's, and I'm getting a C plus in your class. And so I'd say, okay, well, I have office hours for 1 hour before class starts. You're more than welcome to come. And boy, all of a sudden, I had a whole gang in there, and they were all getting A's.
Mm-hmm.
Giving students the opportunity to succeed, mm-hmm. instead of saying you're a failure, I just think is marvelous. The other thing I know you're doing at Lynn Benton that I'd like to see more of across the state, and that's this cooperative program with the university. You happen to have a university that's only a few miles away, and so I know you spend a lot of hours cooperating with and working out a system between Oregon State and Lynn Benton. I'd like you to comment a little bit more about how that works and what the advantages of it are.
So, Senator Monroe, just thank you for your kind comments. I do want to specify that I'm certainly proud of what we do at Lynn Benton, but there's great things being done across the state as a whole. With regards to two things. One, that redesign of developmental education, which I think somebody else might speak more eloquently on, but is exciting work. And I think the principle for us, and has always been for us, is we want to make sure that anything that might be looked at as past failure is not the determinant of future success. And so I think every student who comes to us, we believe, has a capacity to learn and to succeed, and so we invest in them in the best way possible. And I think we're constantly looking for new ways to and better ways to do that. With regards to our partnership with Oregon State University, we certainly think our students are well served when community colleges and universities work closely together and create what I'd like to think of as a seamless pathway that produces a very effective four-year experience for our students. I think the work that we're looking at around transfer can be a very productive step to improve that statewide, and I hope you're looking at that carefully.
Yes, we are. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead.
So to focus a little bit more on completions, and I know you saw this data yesterday in talking about our completions, but I wanted to highlight it again because you can really see when we started the work on student success in 2008 and 2009 that it has a direct impact on the number of completions that we have both in our degrees and certificates. The next slide I wanted to point out is taking a breakdown of our increases in completions. So this is our certificate completions by race and ethnicity. And what you can see here is we're doing a lot better with some of the underrepresented populations in terms of the completions. And this has been a focus of the colleges, particularly around our Latino population. That population certainly is increasing in our community colleges, but our completion for those students is also increasing. We also have this data not just for certificates, but for degrees as well. Again, you can see that both for our Latino population and our Pacific Islander population, we've kind of lead the increases in terms of our completions.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Can you compare that to the percentage overall, the overall percentage increase? That would be interesting as well. Like, so the overall, overall it's increased 200%,
but right.
400% in this, that would be helpful.
I'd be happy to provide that information
for
you.
Thank you.
So the next piece in terms of our work, we see this as long-term work. And as we talk about guided pathways, it's not a pilot program. It's not the next best practice, but it's a rethinking of what we're doing as community colleges. We have started a student success center that's designed to help the colleges move through this work. It is housed at the Oregon Community College Association and is being funded by some of the foundations in Oregon. And our next big piece of work is to create a cohort of colleges that can follow the lead of Lynn Benton Community College around implementing guided pathways. This is not going to be quick work. We see this as an 8 to 10 year project because it is a fundamental rethinking of how we offer classes and supports to our students. And then I wanted to, as we're looking at the guided pathways and the work that we're doing, give you kind of a snapshot of how this impacts the state budget and the state economy. So these are charts that are generated from NCHIMS, which is the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems. And what they have done is they've built spreadsheets that are state-specific. So this is using current data from Oregon. And what this does is this shows you with the current where we are in terms of our degree completions as a percentage, what the changes in personal income, additional revenues generated, additional state revenues generated, and the state cost versus the revenues generated. So this kind of shows our current trajectory. As we do the guided pathways work, and as we increase the completions per 100 FTEs, we don't know exactly what that will look like because there's not research yet that will say you will increase your completions by X percentage points. So what I did is I took our current projections per 100 FTE and increased it by 7 points. And to use the same spreadsheet, this is what it looks like. And so you can see, I think most importantly, in the lower right-hand quadrant, the state costs versus the revenues generated changed astronomically. And so this really is about if we can get the students that come in the door a higher percentage of them in completing, it has a direct impact on both the state budgets and the overall state costs versus revenues generated. And I think this is particularly for a Ways and Means Subcommittee, really important to understand the investment and to show the real numbers in terms of what that investment can mean for the state. So now I'm going to switch gears and turn over to some of the workforce and CTE programs that we do and really talk about, again, the direct impact that those CTE programs have on Oregon's economy and the local community college communities as well. So as we talk about CTE programs, as you know, and I know there's been conversation in the committee, there's a wide variation in terms of the cost for CTE programs. One of the most expensive is our nursing programs, but many of the other very specific CTE programs have very large costs associated with them as well. As you know, the state reimburses on 510 clock hours, and so essentially for each community college, it's a matter of identifying what the key needs are for that community and then figuring out a way to work the finances of it to make sure that that program is offered on behalf of the colleges. So, and this does show you over the years how the mix between particularly lower division transfer and CTE programs has changed. One of the very direct impacts of the loss of investments in community colleges, particularly around the Great Recession, you can see in 2008, 2009, 2010, kind of the trajectory that basically colleges offered more lower division transfer classes and less CTE classes because CTE are more expensive. And so as they had to make choices in limited budgets, some of those choices were to cut CTE programs because of that cost. So we did a study to look at the impact that CTE programs have on Oregon's economy. And this is one example of one community college, Rogue Community College, five programs that look specifically at the number of completers in the program, what their hourly wage using employment data records, and then what the total wages would be for 1 year. And so you can see from five CTE programs at one community college, it generated $3.7 million in wages in 1 year. So I think that really kind of shows the very direct impact that CTE programs have on Oregon's economy. This study was then done for all 17 colleges. This is not comprehensive to all of our CTE programs. Each college picked five programs and matched data with the employment department. And what we found from that is there were 1,800 completers. Average wage was $24. Total one-year wages from those programs was $47 million. And that's just the first year wages. So again, I think it shows the direct link that CTE programs have. We have then did a list talking to all the different community colleges and essentially asking the question, if you had more money, what programs would you offer? And so this is a list. Some of these programs, multiple colleges would offer them. But this gives you an example of all the needs that local communities have. And each one of these programs would, again, generate more wages that would make a difference in the economy. All of these programs, there's a local community need, there's jobs available. We essentially don't have the resources to offer the programs. So.
Mr. Kucher. Representative Lively.
Thank you. So aren't, in some cases though, aren't some of these already offered at some of the community colleges?
Co-chairs, Representative Lively, yes.
Okay.
But with community colleges, our students are place bound. So even though there might be a welding program at
it's
Portland,
not there.
That doesn't help a student that's in Klamath Falls.
Sure. Thank you.
And I'm now going to turn it over to Patty Scott, our president at Southwestern Oregon Community College, to talk in greater detail about CTE programs and what's happening in her community.
Good morning, everyone.
Welcome.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patty Scott, the president at Southwestern Oregon Community College on the beautiful south coast of Oregon. And my district is Western Douglas County and all of Coos and Curry counties, home of Senator Roblin. So when you live in a small rural community and you go to different events or go to the doctor or fundraisers, you and people know who you are and that you work at the college, you frequently, more often than not, are told about what need. Oh, you should offer this program. You should offer this program. We need this, that, and the other thing. So when we get that information, we take it back to the college and do an investigation to determine if that really is isolated or is that something that we should look at offering. And then we try to figure out how to make that happen. So in the last year and a half, that happened with our dental assisting program. We had a number of dentists talk to us about a need for dental assistance. So then we did a focus group, and we brought about 10 to 15 dentists showed up one evening to talk about what their workforce needs are. And so then we decided to pursue creating a dental assisting program. And we were lucky enough to have the medical community support the program so well that they offered equipment that they were getting rid of at a reduced cost, and we have a Department of Labor grant that enabled us to get the program started, because as you saw from Andrea's slides, CTE programs are expensive to start. But we started that program in the fall. We just had a article in the newspaper yesterday about the program, and we have 14 students that will graduate in August. And once they pass their dental assisting certification tests, they are able to go into the workforce. Many of them already have offers, and they'll be making $20 an hour. It's an expensive program. The grant funding is drying up, and we have to figure out as we move into our budget how to fund that program. And those are the hard choices that we make when we've made a commitment to our community, to our employers. How do we keep offering this program? Another program that we have approved and ready to go kind of came out of the same process. We've been in our medical community a lot over the last couple years because we were fundraising for the match money for our health and science building. So we've become very intimate with many of the professionals in all those fields. And one field in particular where one of our alumni manages the medical lab facility at North Bend Medical Clinic, which has sites along the coast, is desperate for medical lab technicians, which that program isn't even on Andrea's list there. We have pursued that. We have that program approved through the state process, ready to offer it, and all we need is the funding to make it happen. So those are just some of the challenges. You know, we've been able to respond. We've created forestry in the last couple of years, digital design, a program specifically at our Curry campus. Lots of needs in the health field because Coos and Curry counties are two of the highest demographics of folks over 65. People are moving there to retire and vacation, and they need to access health facilities. So there is a need and demand, and we just are trying to figure out how to fund it.
Do you believe that we ought to differentiate in terms of state funding between those kinds of higher cost programs and regular or lower cost programs? Because currently we pay the same FTE no matter whether it's a very expensive CTE program or a less expensive general education program. Do you think we ought to differentiate as we do in the K-12 funding? You know, we do give an extra bump if you have if you're trying to teach a handicapped student or a student that is pregnant or a student that, you know, there's various different things in the formula where we differentiate in terms of our funding. Should we be doing that at the community college level as well?
Well, Senator Moreau and members of the committee, I believe that that is something that we're looking at, and I think Andrew might have more information on this. Pass the buck.
So, co-chairs and members of the committee, it is something that certainly has been talked about, and anytime changes are made to the funding formula, I think the question is, are you going to fully fund the CTE programs at the cost? And if they're not fully funded at the cost of the program, it essentially just changes the dynamic mm-hmm. by which colleges might make decisions. I think the bigger question for us as we look at guided pathways, does this help us move along with our work to rethink and redesign, or does it become a barrier? And as we look at guided pathways, one of the pieces of the work is colleges understanding how increasing the students staying in the colleges changes the impact of the funding they get from the state. So essentially, as you think about it as a business, if you retain your customers, it's going to change your business model. I would be hesitant to change other aspects of the business model in a way that might detract from the work around guided pathways. That being said, I think it's going to continue to be a topic of conversation. And if we go forward on a change like that, to really think about how it might impact the decision-making at the local level.
There's no easy answer.
No, there is not.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'm going to move on to some of the budget pieces and talking specifically about the impact on students. So, and I've got two more presidents that will be joining me up here. I'm sorry, one president and one board member, so Debbie and Denise. We, earlier this year, took all the specific cost drivers that are impacting our budgets and put together a spreadsheet and asked each chief financial officer at the colleges to give us how much the impact would be in the first year of this upcoming biennium. And so what this chart shows you is how much, as you kind of roll it up to a statewide number, what the impact is, and then broke it out on a cost per FTE. So these are all new investments, not necessarily investment, but new costs to the colleges above and beyond what they're currently paying. So as you look at the PERS number, this is not the total PERS number that the colleges are paying. This is the increased cost between this year and next year for PERS. The same with the paid sick leave, minimum wage increases, some changes in healthcare that drive up costs. So again, this is not the total healthcare cost. This is just the change. And then the roll up from the Oregon Promise.
Yes. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Oregon Promise roll up. Can you explain that?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, there was some very specific funding that was provided for the colleges last session for the Oregon Promise. Very specifically, there was money that was provided for advisors for the colleges. Each college received one to two advisors depending on their size. And secondly, there was money provided that allowed the colleges to create first-year experience for the cohort of Oregon Promise students to help with retention efforts. So the roll-up cost would be separate from the cost for the Oregon Promise, the grants to the students, but specifically for the colleges to continue those two programs, to continue to have the advisors and continue to offer the first-year experience.
Go ahead.
Are you saying that, thank you, Ms. Kocher, are you saying that every year we're going to have $4.6 million additional cost for providing Oregon Promise?
Co-chair, as Representative Wisnett, I think the hope would certainly be that as budgets hopefully someday increase, that those costs would become part of the overall budget for community colleges. What this represents at a budget of $550 that was proposed in the governor's budget, which is the same we have this year, this is the unmet cost between where we are now.
Mr. Chair, I don't understand that. We provided how much more money? We provided the money, and we just passed a bill to be sure we fully funded it for the Oregon Promise, which I think we all support. Maybe not the 4 year. I didn't say that 4 years ago. But we provided money to train, and most of the community colleges used the money to train their own staff to do counseling. And now you're saying that we're going to have to do that every biennium? So that's $2.3 million a year that we're going to have additional funds to operate Oregon Promise? I just don't understand what's that expense. I'm sorry.
Okay. Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett. So very specifically, we received one-time money for our college to hire an advisor. So the small colleges got one advisor, the larger colleges two advisors. There's continuing costs to continue to employ those advisors to benefit the Oregon Promise students. If we received a budget that's larger than $550, we would no longer need to receive a separate appropriation. So this is just the costs that we have that aren't funded at a current budget level of $550. So certainly if the colleges received the larger budget, that would essentially become part of it. So there wouldn't be a separate line item on that. The other pieces on here, not just the state-driven costs, but we also
Mr. Chair Fox.
Representative Wisdom.
I'm sorry. It was my understanding, I was on the policy subcommittee that worked this, and it was my understanding, we first based it on the Tennessee model, which used volunteer mentors to get people through the program. And a lot of colleges, I was told, were going to train teachers or staff to help do this. We don't need to train them every year. I don't understand. Are you talking strictly about the additional FTE that you're going to have to monitor this? Is that what we're talking about?
So, co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, as the Oregon Promise was implemented, that piece of the Tennessee model that had individual mentors was not part of the program. Instead, each college hired one employee to provide that advising to students. And then the second piece of it was colleges designed and implemented first-year experience. So the staff cost to deliver the first-year experience is an ongoing expense for those students.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So the other two pieces on this slide are the federally driven cost.
Mr. Roblin wants to...
I'll just try to clarify one more time. Mm-hmm. So we had a pocket of extra money, and we had Johnson and Haas said, why don't we help get this off to the right start? So what we will do is we'll use some of that, separate from the promise, to do a couple things. And one was to buy the counselors. The other was to ask for what would be the best way to help those kids be successful. They came up with a plan that basically said what we're going to do is have this promise experience. We're going to have this deal to show kids how to be successful. It was one-time money. It was what we had left over in some other pot. Most of us understood that if that goes away, those programs go away, because that's what it was paying for. And it was one-time money. It wasn't put into their regular budget. It was show us how best to get this whole thing started. That money going forward is that money. So if we want to keep those programs, there's an expectation we're going to have to find that money to do them. Promise will go on whether we have that money or not. This is a deal if... We have found that it has been very successful. Those kids have signed up for the next term. We're seeing progress for all those kids. The community colleges, I believe, and many of us who have watched it, believe that money was instrumental in helping the success rate of the program. So we have a decision to make. We had one-time money. Are we going to put one-time money in again to fund that, or are we just going to fund the kids going to Promise? That's the decision we have to make.
Mr. Co-Chair.
And that's what the 4.6
The policy committee, we heard a lot and had presentation by the company that Abbott or whatever.
Abbott. There's some.
So
of them
no
that use
community
that.
Colleges use those.
Yes, some do.
And are they? Is this concluding their contract to continue that? Is this bigger?
So, co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, some of the colleges did use Avid to essentially what Avid does was to train on how to do first-year experiences. Other colleges design their own first-year experiences. What this represents certainly is the money that will continue the staff time to deliver those first-year experience courses. So.
Mr. Co-Chair, again, I won't go any further with this, but I think in part of the ways and means, the program now is going to be, what, $40 million a year, but we've got a $4 million extra charge on here. That's a pretty significant percentage. $40 million, you've got 10% is going to just the counseling, which I understand the importance of that, but I think the ways and means people should look at that. I don't know. Thank you.
We are the ways.
We are.
That's the way it's right up there.
Co-chairs are working on that.
Mr. Chair, in terms of, it's not $40 million a year. It's $40 right. million for biennium. But it will likely be a little more than that, given the, I guess, for the lack of a better term, the success of the program in terms of the number of students. And I've asked the agency to sort of work up, based on the most recent quarter project or enrollment, to get a new projection on that.
And Mr. Co-Chair, I support Oregon Promises, and I voted for this.
Thank you very much. We talk about it virtually every day.
Yes, we do.
Andrea, go ahead.
Certainly. So we also have indicated on here changes in federal law that also drive up the cost. And this chart essentially captures the legislative ask for the community colleges for this session. In the governor's budget, we were funded at $550 million, which is the same amount that we received last time. What we are asking for is $634 million, which represents the $14 million of the current service level roll-up, and the additional $70 million, which are these cost drivers that are outside the current service level calculations that are the actual cost for community colleges.
Yeah, it is. It's there.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Can you just tell us what FSLA and CLEAR Act are, please?
Yes. FSLA, and actually this one has been put on hold at this time, so we would not need funding unless it were to change. But this is the change in overtime rules at the federal level. And so that's the cost to implement the change in overtime rules. The CLEAR Act is around safety and security and other items at the community college level. It has very specific requirements for staffing at the community college. Many of our colleges have had to hire additional staff to be compliant with the CLEAR Act that comes down from the federal level. And so this represents the cost for them to hire those staff and to be compliant with federal law. So this chart looks at the three pieces of revenue for community colleges. Now, I know you saw this chart yesterday. What's different in this chart is it goes back to 1998-90. And the reason why I wanted to highlight this for you, because it shows the direct impact of Measure 5 on the funding for community colleges. So what this chart shows is pre-Measure 5, property taxes were 50% of the overall budget for community colleges. At the time, the state provided about 30%, and tuition paid for 20%. You can see in the 1993 to 94, where it essentially crossed over as the implementation of Measure 5 came into effect, where the state essentially made up the difference in cost for Measure 5. And certainly in the around 2000, you can certainly see the state investment was a little over 50% of the cost, while property taxes had gone down to about 20% of the cost. So what you can see that happened in the last several years is that line of the investment from the state has really flipped with tuition. And so what we see now is students are the biggest contributor to the cost of their education. And that's been really over the last 4 or 5 years, that impact on students. So I wanted to kind of show traditional, you know, the kind of trajectory since Measure 5, and certainly an argument can be made that some of the lost revenue from Measure 5 is now being borne by our students rather than the state. I wanted to provide some information on tuition. And so recognizing that colleges are in the process of setting tuition for this upcoming year, Some of them have made tuition decisions, some of them haven't. So we wanted to, as that's a local decision done by the local community colleges, we wanted to provide some information on it, but not provide specific college information as they're still kind of in negotiations around that. But this kind of captures what kind of the tuition, the range of tuition increases would be from the community colleges.
And again, what's the average tuition then that that's added on to?
Co-chair Monroe, it's not, the number is not at the top of my head, but it's around a little less than $100 per credit hour.
Okay. Thank you.
So generally speaking, it's between a 1% and 7% tuition increase, depending on which institution. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Denise Frisbee, who is a locally elected board member at Portland Community College, to share with you a little bit about how local elected board members grapple with the tuition and how they make their decisions on that.
Thank you, Andrea. Good morning, Senator Monroe, Representative Smith Warner, and members of the committee. I, as Andrea said,
for the record,
my name is Denise Frisbee,
yeah,
and I am a member of the Portland Community College board. I also serve on the Oregon Community College Association board as vice president. So Andrea
and
had asked
and
that
your salary in that position.
It's very, yeah, it's rising all the time.
Doubled last year.
Wonderful.
Thank you. I'm sorry. It's a volunteer position.
It is, and a very rewarding one. Not a very well-paid one. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about the process we go through as a board to make the unenviable decision of establishing the tuition for our students. We set the tuition earlier than we set the budget because we are still working with the kind of things that you're working with, and we're planning on addressing that as you help us with that information. We have a lengthy and considered process. We have a 40-member stakeholder committee. We go out to every college campus. We have meet with the faculty. We meet with the staff. We have three public board meetings, and then we establish our tuition. Much in the same process that Andrea's slides show you, we take what are our revenues and what are our costs. Tuition makes up 44% of our general fund revenues for the college, and the state is 40%. So the things that come into play are the cost drivers that Andrea's slides indicated. As they rise and are out of our control, we have to address those. We also have our own strategic initiatives, which Greg Kamen mentioned to you, as we're looking at guided pathways and seamless transfers. The kind of things we know we need to do to get students to a successful point means that we have to change our business model in certain ways by adding more advisors and addressing the very things he talked about, making clear pathways and clear structures so that students know they can get to their goals, whether it's a transfer or an associate degree or a certificate. So as we look at our strategic initiatives and we put dollars on that, we put all of this into the mix with the cost drivers and the available revenue, and we work very hard to keep tuition down for our students. We will be having a 7% tuition increase, which is lower than actually I had heard some of the others. We're kind of in the middle of the pack of the community colleges in terms of our tuition. We're currently at $97 or $98 a credit hour. So it comes, if you presume a full load, full-time student, it comes in around $4,800 a year, and that will go up. Our students were very practical this year, and they worked with us because we did so much outreach to explain it. But I don't want you to get the impression that they're happy, because they're not. And every dollar is a significant impact to them. And the kind of settings in which most of our students find themselves are pretty dramatic. So we're observing food insecurity, housing insecurity. We know that transportation is one of the six largest impediments to students completing. To that end, we've been working with in our region, Southwest Corridor Project and TriMet, to really improve the transportation offers. But we also run a supremely expensive shuttle service to get among our various campuses at a significant cost. We have food pantries. And we offer free mental health counseling. We have inadequate child care. So we take on a lot of these services that students really need to be able to do this task of entering and completing in time, making the best use of their federal loans. We also have a very successful financial advising program, so we've been able to reduce our default level significantly down to 16%. So that's great, but there's still default and there's still loans. So that's the kind of situation we find ourselves in addressing the CTE programs, and I think Andrea's slides made that clear. It's a harder because they are more costly. If you're hiring a nursing instructor, that nurse could be earning more money in the field, yeah, or it could be instructing, and the equipment is expensive. We haven't reached the differential tuition because we're trying to keep the cost down for students, but as was mentioned, that is always something that's under discussion and may have to go. We work with our business partners in the community trying to respond to the demands of the region for workforce training. And in some cases, it's very specific and with very specific partners. And in some cases, it's sort of a broad base. We know we need more medical assistance. We know we need more dental assistance. So that's the approach we take. That's the way all these pieces fit together, what you're doing at this level and how we're doing it at our level. You're probably glad we have to make the actual tuition call. But we thank you for your work at looking at how these pieces fit together and what it means as it impacts our students.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So,
go ahead.
So as we look at the impact on students, it's more than just tuition. And I'm going to turn it over to Debbie Durr to talk a little bit about a national study that Mount Hood participated in that shows the other impacts on students, particularly around housing and food insecurity.
So good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee. I'm Debbie Durr. I'm president of Mount Hood Community College. Mount Hood is a community college that serves East Multnomah County, a sliver of Hood River County, and Far East Clackamas County. So we serve urban, suburban, and rural areas of our district. That's important because within that context, we also are the district that serves the most impoverished residents in the state of Oregon. As Director Frisbee was talking about the realities of setting tuition, often we talk about affordability only in regards to the cost of tuition. The idea being that should we as community colleges decrease or hold the cost of tuitions down, students will be okay. They'll be able to afford school, their debt will be less. But the reality is that the cost of tuition is only one very small piece of the affordability matrix. Mount Hood was involved in a national study. The primary researcher, Sarah Goldrick Rabb, a national researcher on college affordability, presents the reality that over the last 5 years, it has become increasingly clear that the living expenses associated with productive enrollment, which to us means completion in higher education, constitutes substantial barriers for our students. At a time when access to post-secondary education truly is at an all-time high, growing up in poverty and being homeless closes the door to education that we work so diligently to keep open. As I stated before, Mount Hood Community College participated in a national study on homelessness and food insecurity, how many of our students are hungry. This study was supported through the Association of Community College Trustees and the Wisconsin Hope Lab, and this is what Mount Hood learned. 11.7% of Mount Hood Community College students are homeless, 12%. 40.1% of our students experience food insecurity. And what that means is, when will I eat next? How will I afford to feed my family? And over 50% of our students experience housing insecurity. Now, in East Multnomah County, we have the most affordable housing in the Portland metropolitan area. And we have seen an influx of individuals coming into that area because of that. The apartments that are across the street from the college, a one-bedroom apartment is $1,200 per month. $1,200 per month. Affordable housing.
Yeah.
So I always talk about our students coming to us with backpacks. But the reality is that those backpacks don't have books in them. What's in those books is the worry that they bring of when their next meal will be. Will they have enough money to pay their rent, utilities, cost of transportation to even come to school? Who will take care of their children while they attend class or work? What are the health and human services needs that they have to go to school? What we found through this study, and we're very close to the national average, is that this hits those students who are most fragile and their families. It hits those individuals who come to us from diverse backgrounds, particularly our African American and Latino families. It comes to us for those families who have lived chronically in poverty. And the reality, as we looked at this, is how close so many more of our students are to being homeless. So why am I talking about this? I'm talking about this, as you can see, the growing cost of providing education to our students. It continues to go up. They're not costs that we can necessarily control. Representative Wisnett talked about why are we putting more money? When Mount Hood Community College serves on an annual basis 28,000 students, and we have 4 academic advisors. That fifth one, for that increase in enrollment we experienced because of the Oregon Promise, was huge. And that's the reality that your community colleges are experiencing. So we hope, as you are looking at and making recommendations for the budget, you will also consider that affordability is far more than just the cost of tuition.
Yeah. And as we look at these issues, particularly around housing insecurity and food insecurity for our students, one of the possible solutions is to take a look at all the human service programs in the state and take a look and say, is there a way that we can look comprehensively at all the different support services for our students and look at them in a way that best helps students move out of poverty through a community college and into a program that they can complete and into a job? And I think that's some additional work that we can do in future legislative sessions to take a look at that. I think particularly around SNAP benefits and TANF benefits and looking at the barriers that might be in the way of students receiving those benefits.
Deb, can you talk to us a little bit about the capital needs of the college? My good friend Senator Thompson was aghast that part of your proposed bond is to pay off debt.
That's correct. Senator Monroe, Representative Warner Smith, members of the committee, Mount Hood Community College just celebrated its 51st birthday. And in 1974, we passed our last general obligation bond. We have not passed a bond since 1974. Capital bonds are important because they help to rebuild buildings, they help to keep buildings up to date, they help to build new facilities to meet growing demands in business and industry. Mount Hood has not passed a bond, not for the lack of trying.
I know.
I know. But what we have then faced is with 50-year-old buildings, capital needs that included replacing our entire electrical system at our Gresham campus. It blew up. It literally failed, and we had to replace it. And how we had to do that because of the cost was to borrow money. One of our board members, Tina Ainsley, talks about using our credit card. So we have had to go out and borrow money to be able to address, address our electrical needs at the Gresham campus. We have had to address HVAC needs and safety needs at the Gresham campus. Our Maywood campus was built in 1926, and it also has substantial challenges. So when a college has to go out and borrow money rather than be able to use capital resources, it then very dramatically impacts the operational dollars that are available to provide the services and programming, address new programs and current technical education. So we are I won't say we're complete unique, but we are somewhat unique in that way. But the capital resources are just essential when you're looking at those buildings. And for most of the community colleges, I would say that the $8 million, thank you so much, please continue to support that, that comes to our campuses, comes to our colleges, is vital. It has to be matched. Mount Hood has not had the ability to do that yet. So we're in a position, and many of our sister colleges, and having to do capital fundraising to be able to match those dollars.
And why is Mount Hood worse off than most of the other community colleges in terms of meeting its capital needs?
I'm almost Representative Monroe. It really is because we have not been able to keep up in the manner that some of our, I won't say all of our sister colleges have been able to keep up with those capital demands because we have not been able to pass that general obligation bond. Hence.
But doesn't that have something to do with the fact that you have less capital?
Oh, absolutely.
Than per student than virtually any other community college in the state.
Well, we have zero capital outside of the small amount of money, the $400,000 a year, that we can put aside for deferred maintenance.
But a bond of a certain size costs the individual poor homeowner in your district more than in a wealthier district.
That would be true, because we don't have the industry that some of our other neighbors have. But I will say, even there, our tax rate does tend to be lower. And so that cost, depending upon what we're looking at, is still considerably lower than what our K-12 partners would have to pay.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I'm sorry I had to zip out for hearings, housing hearings and other committees. I caught your slide as, around the sort of the social need. I'm not sure if you're aware, one of your board members asked me to submit House Bill 2410. It never got a hearing, unfortunately, but it would have asked for, he wanted Michael Calcano, was one of your board members, wanted bond dollars for housing that, the community college has land. So Senator Mona Sanderson and I sponsored that bill. I wish it would have gotten a hearing, because I think it would, I think our community colleges generally, some of them have the ability to build out housing and to look at addressing some of the needs on their properties. To meet those high social barriers, and just any way we can help, if that is something your community college is interested in, certainly want to be helpful and have subsequent conversations with community colleges about student housing and being able to meet some of those social needs for students.
Thank you.
Okay. So at this point, we wanted to talk about specific budget realities and lost opportunities at the community colleges. So I have three presidents that will very briefly talk about the budget realities at their colleges. So I'm going to step aside and let the three of them come up and talk with you to end our presentation today.
Thank you.
And we're running out of time, so you'll need to be succinct. Welcome, ladies. Who's first?
I'm first. Good morning. I'm Brigida Reisling. I'm the president at Oregon Coast Community College in Lincoln County. Thank you for this opportunity to speak and share the experience out on the coast. We are one of the smallest community colleges in Oregon. We serve Lincoln County, which is a stunning place on the Oregon coast, filled with tourists starting about now all the way through October. Their reality is quite different from the reality for our 46,000 year-round residents. We have a median household income of $35,000 to $40,000, depending on whether you live in Lincoln City or Newport, compared to Washington County median household income of $60,000. We also trail the Oregon average in high school diplomas and college degrees, and unfortunately run ahead of the Oregon average of students leaving high school without diplomas. This is a community that really needs its community college. Every day I hear from employers, the ports, the boatyards, the school district, the banks, the fisheries, Georgia Pacific's mill, emergency planning and law enforcement. They all tell me that they have open jobs at all levels, and they believe the college should provide more workforce training programs to meet these needs. And I agree with them. We also hear from students who want more career pathways offered locally and more robust university transfer paths such as STEM, and I agree with them. But here's the situation, though. Oregon Coast is already addressing a structural budget deficit. We cannot do the additional things that our community needs and hold down tuition without increased and predictable state funding. Some examples for us. The school district, they have come to us and said that they can't hire and retain enough teachers. They're hiring 60 teachers a year and can't hang on to them there on the coast. They want to partner with us and a university for a Grow Your Own program. Meanwhile, employers, students, and a countywide coalition have come to us because they want a childcare education program. There are no resources in our budget to start and sustain an education track. Same is true for maritime, emergency planning, the trades, STEM fields, and partnering with the new Oregon State University Marine Studies Initiative campus and all those areas that were asked about. We have, over the years, this is our 30th birthday, been able to offer some really successful programs. For example, our nursing program, 150 nurses have completed, and they go on to have family incomes of starting at $40,000. That's phenomenal. We have an aquarium science program that pulls in students from all over the U.S. But the problem is that over 30 years, those are the programs we have been, the pace at which that we can add and be responsive to our community is just not acceptable. Another gap is that we don't have the sustained resources to really change to a college-going culture in Lincoln County. We obtained a competitive student success grant last year and started a phenomenal program called Navigate. Our college advisor is in each of our high schools on a weekly basis providing outreach on how to get into, pay for, and be successful in college. We are keenly focused on first-generation poverty and underserved students. The advisor stays in constant communication with these potential college students, helping them to navigate the barriers that they face every day. When these students enroll with us, including many of those Oregon Promise students, the Navigate program provides college retention and success services to them. We're committed to keeping this program running, although the grant ends in June, because we're already seeing such great success. Another gap for us is that we're on the path to independent accreditation, the last community college in Oregon to do so. And there's a tremendous amount of work and resources needed. This, like everything else new, is not funded. We make things work in all these important areas, new programming, student success, and independent accreditation, by piecing together grants, reducing resources to existing areas, and yes, increasing tuition and fees. We also make it work by providing non-competitive salaries to our excellent and dedicated faculty and staff, and through extremely lean staffing in all areas. And in trying to balance all of this, we inevitably slow down our progress and responsiveness to our communities. We have always been that little college that could, and we remain optimistic. And in light of all the community demand for workforce development, we have a workforce building on the state capitol construction list. With this facility, we intend to build on our partnerships with the school district, local employment, the maritime sector, and Oregon State University to brighten the futures for our students, to meet employer workforce needs, and to increase our capacity, be that economic engine and path to the middle class that Lincoln County and the coast so desperately needs. It would be a great thing indeed if, along with the building, there were funding to provide the new programming and ensure student success and completion in those programs. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, Co-Chair Monroe, Smith Warner, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dana Young, and I'm the president at Treasure Valley Community College in beautiful Ontario, Oregon. So I had a few things I wanted to share with you today, and I want to start off by thanking you for all of the good work that you do, because you have a really difficult job and some serious decisions to make. I wanted to talk a little bit about how further cuts to community colleges and to our budgets would drastically reduce our ability to be able to help rebuild jobs in our communities and retrain workers. Reducing classes and having to cut programs reduces an enrollment and reduces our enrollment in times when people are needing more workers and not fewer workers. So I'm here not only to talk about Treasure Valley Community College's needs, but how can we preserve funding for community colleges as a whole to meet the needs of the citizens in our state and our region. Malheur County has a poverty rate of more than 22%, one of the highest in the state. In addition, more than 30% of our families receive family services from Oregon Health and Human Services. 30%. Of our families. We know that a lack of education and employable skills often is the root cause of poverty. At TVCC, we see our role in the community as being the first responder in this economic crisis, and the solution is education and jobs. The college's ability to quickly meet the area's workforce needs has been critical to the economic recovery of our region. And as part of our investment and your investment in local opportunities and in CTE programs, I'd like to share with you several partnerships that we've been working on at Treasure Valley Community College. So in partnership with St. Alphonsus Medical Center, they have continued to help fund our nursing program. And this fall, we will be beginning a medical office assistant program. Our local high schools, we're in a consortium with them. It's a great partnership. It's called Poverty to Prosperity, Treasure Valley Tech. And we're doing welding, computer science, automated controls, early childhood education, and certified nursing assistant courses. And this is reaching down into the high schools and working directly with Ontario, Nyssa, Vail. And now we're adding all of the smaller outlying high schools to it. And even stretching and reaching right across that river into Idaho and getting a number of those students to come over into Oregon and take those courses while they're in high school. We're working closely with an organization called Silverhawk Aviation, and we're establishing a fixed-wing aviation program this fall. It's a need for our local community, and that is in partnership with the City of Ontario and Ontario Airport. We work very closely with the Snake River Correctional Institution, and we have a building constructions trade program for the men that are in that facility so that they have skills when they get out to actually earn a family wage. We've provided customized on-site training for Simplot, for industrial manufacturing and automated controls, for Balin Manufacturing out of Baker City. We do welding training for their men and women. And this summer we're doing a number of summer CTE camps where students will get to come in and fly gliders, work with drones, and several other STEM activities that we have provided for them. So we're doing a lot with a little, and we're working really hard. We're being good stewards of the funds, and I would just urge all of you to continue the good work that you're doing and focus on community colleges, because we really are the workforce trainers, and these budgets are so important to us out in these local communities. And just for the record, Malheur County has never passed a capital construction bond in the 55 years that we've been in existence. It's tough. Yeah. You know, it's tough in these communities. So thank you for your time.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Thank you, committee, for keeping here until the 10 o'clock hour. Co-Chair Monroe, Smith Warner, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joanne Truesdell. I'm president of Clackamas Community College. I'm in my 11th year. I have 37 years of experience in community colleges, first as a community college student and graduate from a working family. Didn't qualify for much, and certainly my parents weren't going to disclose how much income they made as a matter of personal pride. Several things that have occurred, I think, about lost opportunities that are really important for you to know, I think, as Ways and Means. One.
The mic is very sensitive. If you stay about 6 inches away.
Oh, thank you.
About 6 inches away from it, it'll be better.
And I do have a loud voice. For you to know, and that is about lost opportunities over the last 17 years. We did not come here today because this year happens to be the year that we lost funding or that we're concerned about growth for this year. I want to talk with you briefly to sketch out for those of you who maybe weren't here at the legislature or weren't around in Oregon about the last 17 years. The very first hit for community colleges that made a structural change in our revenue was in the 2001-03 session. Two things happened. One was that the community education courses no longer counted for reimbursable, and that was after the colleges already fielded those courses and paid for that instruction. The second was one payment, 3 months worth of our, annual revenue was deferred until the next biennium. It's in perpetuity. What that did is it created a pressure on our ending fund balances in order to make sure we had the working capital to make payroll first and provide the services that we had said we would provide to our community and our students, and then recoup that back in the second year. Structurally, what that did for us is it took all the theory of ending fund balance of 3 to 5% that had been holding for the last 30 years in community colleges and wiped that out, because that now became working capital. As soon as state funding started becoming again in about 05 back up, we started eking away at trying to get an ending fund balance that the Government Finance Officers Association nationally recommends, which is 10 to 15%, because we are now in a volatile state. So you start eking that back. You've already cut, as a result of the 2001-03, somewhere around 6% of your workforce. We go into 2008 and tank right after a lovely session where we were theoretically to receive more money, $500 million. At that point, and I'll tell you how it worked at Clackamas, at that point, I laid off a quarter of the full-time staff over a three-year period of time. Our community college sisters, some who couldn't eke back as much ending fund balance, needed to take the ending fund balance and not only try to deliver what was happening, but that deferred payment became a bridge loan. And so every year in perpetuity, the last 3 months of the biennium, they have to go out and borrow money in order to make payroll. That's the structure by which we operate in as we ask you for the $654 million. That's the part where it's fascinating. Why wouldn't we have more academic advisors for Oregon Promise? Why wouldn't we be able to expand programs? It's because we've lost so much in the way of funding over the last 17 years. It has created a perpetual structural deficit by which we live by. For our students who are part-time, who are on the rung in Clackamas County, working 65% of our students are working more than 32 hours a week. They are on the first rung. They're right at about anywhere from $14 to $17 an hour. They're often students who have a dependent. They are working, they're not qualifying for much, and our ability, the lost opportunity for them is specifically, we cannot field evening courses that remain small enough to make books so that those students have opportunities for continuous year-round educational opportunities, both career technical as well as lower division collegiate transfer. We cannot meet the needs of our companies, which ask us to help them be competitive and to take their current incumbent workers and help them get better skills. We can't do that. Those are things that we try desperately to do. For us, the other pieces that we are unable to do is simply to add more courses, accelerated courses, in all of our STEM programs. And this is where the capital comes in for Clackamas Community College. We have one chemistry lab that supports 28,000 students. One chemistry lab. That's why capital is important to us. So thank you very much.
Joanne, we appreciate you coming. Members of this committee, I appreciate you staying for these college presidents who've given us their time this morning, even though we've run 15 minutes over. I think it was well worth it. And to everybody that's here in this presentation, the co-chair and I are looking at budgets right now. We know that the budgeted amount for community colleges is inadequate. We have you really high on our list of add-backs if we get additional revenue. Hopefully that will happen. Mr. Wilson, anything?
On Monday will be public testimony, Mr. Chair, for the community colleges and related issues, but narrow focus on community colleges. And then next week will be the public university sector.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much, ladies, and we're adjourned.
Rod and I want to.
And we're adjourned.